Welcome to Two Friends Talk History, a podcast where two friends talk history. I'm Sophia.
And I'm Liam.
We're two historians.
And friends.
Who want to learn as much as we can about history, not just one focus or topic, but world history.
Everything.
To do this, we choose a theme and we scurry away to do research for the story. We don't know what the other has chosen until we sit and record the episode. We learn as we research too, and we're so glad you're joining us on this journey.
This week's theme has been suggested by one of our patrons, Nell. So thank you, Nell, for this. And she chose the theme, Dysfunctional Families.
And I can't wait. This week, I will be discussing a twisted tale of two Cleopatras and a ton of Ptolemies.
Wow, that's a tongue twister. Say that five times.
No!
And I'm going to take us back to the anarchy. What? The 12th century contest between cousins, King Stephen of England and Queen Matilda of England. Two rulers? How did that happen? You'll find out.
As a way of thanking our members for their support by joining us on Patreon, we offer members-only content including extras like additional bespoke art, contextual images, maps, 100-word histories where we highlight and discuss our own adventures and travels through historical places and periods, shout-outs, and all for the cost of a pint or a flat white each month.
All right, let's dive in. Okay, Sophia, you're up first. So I want to know about the Ptolemies. I want to know about the Cleopatras. Tell me about all of them.
To preface this, they all have the same names. So before we jump in, you're going to hear a lot of the name Ptolemy and you're going to hear a lot of the name Cleopatra. And that's because the Ptolemies super duper liked branding and they were very consistent in their branding. So I have picked out epithets of the different people involved and I will be calling them by those epithets instead of just their normal formal dynastic names, just to keep it simple. So I hope it's understandable and easy to follow along because I mean, it took me a while. It's quite confusing when you don't have, when you just go by their Ptolemy 1 through 100.
No, that sounds perfect. And I think just to clarify, when we say epithet, it's like the descriptor of the name. So like Alexander the Great, William the Conqueror,
Absolutely.
You know.
Perfect, yeah. So this week I wanted to discuss a name that is universally known, basically, Cleopatra, but not the one we immediately think of. Obviously, Cleopatra VII was the last of the Ptolemies. She's the famous one that you all, you know, you picture in your mind with Rome. But I wanted to discuss the incredibly dysfunctional family antics, murder, secret marriages, and more murders of the mother-daughter co-queens who shared a husband, Cleopatra II and III, and Ptolemy VIII of the Ptolemaic dynasty.
This is already confusing.
I know.
Brilliant.
It's just,
I love it.
It's like a tangled web of Ptolemies. Mm-hmm. It's fun to rhyme with too. This takes place in the Hellenistic period of Mediterranean history between 323 BCE and 30 BCE in the notoriously dysfunctional Ptolemaic royal family, who also happened to be the longest living dynasty of the Hellenistic kingdoms. So Liam, you studied one of these successor kingdoms in great detail. What do you know about the Ptolemies and like kind of the Hellenistic politics of the time?
Oh God, Hellenistic history. I mean, yes, I've studied a lot of that in my day. So we're talking about the period of, I suppose, Greek power after Alexander the Great. I studied the Seleucids mainly, I studied people who interacted with the Seleucids a lot, and they were based in, you know, Mesopotamia and Syria and that region. But the Ptolemies were the ones that went to Egypt and took over Egypt. And I'm very well aware of their choice of marriage for their children, which is something I'm sure that you'll get into. Yep. So they were the Greek dynasty that ruled over native Egyptians, and they made themselves into a cult almost, didn't they? Am I right
sure
in saying that?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting because you've obviously studied quite intensely the region that was interacting with them the most in this period, just because of proximity. And I tend to focus on these guys because of the material culture that got made and transmitted throughout the Mediterranean. So it's kind of funny to me that we have this mutual sphere of intersection. But for the topic today, I'll give a quick run through of the sort of historical context that and the way that the Ptolemies were positioned and relevant in the Mediterranean briefly before diving in. But yeah, I think the one thing that is very consistent when you talk about this dynasty is just everybody's go-to is just messed. Like they are just can't stop killing each other, you know, brothers and sister marriage, that sort of thing. So yeah.
Brother-sister marriage.
It's a classic combo.
It's not great.
It sure doesn't work out well in a lot of ways. So the Ptolemaic dynasty was founded in 305 BCE under Ptolemy I Soter, which means Ptolemy the Savior. And he was one of Alexander the Great's generals who came over from Macedonia, grew up with him, conquered the world with him, had all these exciting exploits and an excellent education growing up as well. And once Alexander the Great died in 323 BCE, the lands he conquered were basically split amongst his generals, and then they created their independent little kingdoms. Ptolemy beelined down to Egypt. He was just like, I know where the money is, and I'm heading there.
Yeah, I was just going to say, he was like, where's the richest part?
Boom. Absolutely. And it's not to say that Egypt was easy to subjugate, you know, probably, but it seemingly was a fairly smooth transition for at least him and the first few generations of Ptolemies.
And as well as that, I mean, Egypt was relatively homogenous compared to, say, the Seleucid Empire, which had a huge array of different peoples within it and much more complicated to forge unity.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, that's like trying to put a blanket over Europe and be like, it's Europe. And you're like, yeah, no, exactly. It's a lot more different than that. Or
like
even
country
more.
Of Africa.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. They're all the same. No,
they're all
they're
the
not.
Same.
Like, so not. So yeah, it's that kind of thing. So Egypt is quite large. It was, yeah, you're right, fairly homogenized. And they already had a long history of foreign rulers coming in and setting themselves up as kings and kind of continuing or changing the cultural practices. But like the status quo sometimes really didn't change that much for the average person. So it wasn't, you know, a disastrous imposition to go from Alexander the Great, who was the preceding king of Egypt at that point briefly, to Ptolemy. And he waited about 20 years to actually officially found his dynasty. So he was sort of hedging his bets, seeing what was going to happen in the shakeout after Alexander the Great died, and there was the battle for successors and all that sort of thing. And he just kind of held Egypt. Let's see what happens. And even took Alexander the Great's body as it was being sent back from Babylon. So he installed it in Memphis, in the official capital of Egypt at that point, because Alexandria hadn't been built yet.
Yeah, but that was a major coup, because having the body of like the great conqueror in your territory, it gave legitimacy. And I think he was very clever for doing that, because I think Seleucus Nicanor, who was the guy who created the Seleucid Empire and a rival of Ptolemy, really wanted that too.
He sure did. He sure did. And he was so much closer. Technically, he could have gotten it more easily, potentially. Maybe he didn't think of it. But yes, they installed it there, and the Ptolemies continued Greek traditions and institutional roots back from Macedon, but they blended Egyptian cultural customs as well to maintain control over the native Egyptian population. For instance, Ptolemy I's son, Ptolemy II, and his wife Arsinoe II, positioned themselves as like the defenders of Greek freedom against Macedonian aggression and stuff like that, where, you know, this is quite a stretch coming from Egypt all the way into northern Greece. Like, you know, Ptolemy was forging alliances with Greek city-states on their, you know, in between his capital and theirs, and establishing festivals like the Ptolemaea in 249 BCE in Delos, which, you know, continued Ptolemaic involvement in the Cyclades, even though their territories kind of shrunk down a little bit over time. And just, yeah, he sent money out. He was giving political support, military support, to just make sure there was their presence was felt throughout the Mediterranean. And, you know, and this was the case with Athens as well, where the Ptolemies were recognized as friends of the notable city through festivals and other symbolic gestures. So, you know, there was a real desire to project themselves as, you know, part of this Greek world. And so there was strong competition among the successor kingdoms, as you alluded to. And that led to many military conflicts, but as well, they were also incredibly competitive with each other about who had the most resplendent capital cities. Their dynasty founded one of the most culturally sophisticated capital cities of the ancient world at the time, and a city we know today, Alexandria. And it was innovative with sciences, philosophy, literature, and arts, and they flourished under this kingdom. With the famous lighthouse of the Pharos Lighthouse and Library of Alexandria, the city became like a cultural beacon. So, you know, just to sum up, like the Ptolemies came in as conquerors, but they didn't just conquer Egypt. They added their own brand, their own stamp on it, and tried to, you know, try to create like beacon focal point. And it's easy to think of this period as sand, sandals, and swords, but it's important to recognize that a big part of the patronage of the kings and queens of Egypt, under the Ptolemies especially, it was the projection of their cultural sophistication in a Hellenic-centered world at that time. While the Hellenistic kingdoms continued to battle each other into positions of weakness that Rome would eventually capitalize on and become the dominant force in the Mediterranean, they also engaged in nonstop sabotage between themselves. So it was like a double whammy.
Yep, and a great setting for some dysfunctional families, I think.
Absolutely. This is precisely the setup for our story, which begins with two brothers, the elder Ptolemy VI, Philometor, which means mother-loving, in the best possible way, I presume, and little brother Ptolemy VIII, Physcon, which means fat, effectively.
Or Ptolemy Physcon.
Yeah, so Ptolemy VIII was getting fat shamed all the way into his nickname. But, you know, from coinage, it actually might have been the case. He was pretty rotund.
And also, I don't think, you know, the Hellenistic kingdoms were known for their sensitivities to differences. No. So
certainly not. If there was one physical trait they could point to, they would. These super Ptolemy bros were given co-rulership, which included their sister Cleopatra II, into the Sixth Syrian War between 170 and 168 BCE, and which was a series of ongoing skirmishes over the bordering territories around ancient Mesopotamia, and that was going on for generations.
And co-rulership between siblings was common enough, wasn't it? Or is this unusual?
Co-rulership between kings and queens, very normal. Obviously, the kings were the bigger authority in that relationship up to this point. But in this case, having the third sibling in the mix was a little unusual.
In my head, that's like a recipe for disaster already.
Oh, 100%. It just gets so bad. Philometor was captured by the Seleucids, and Physcon had sole rule of Egypt for a while Philometor was in Syrian territory. When the war was over, Philometor was restored to the throne, and the bros basically never stopped fighting amongst themselves after that happened. It's a tangle of one brother gaining the upper hand and expelling the other, then raising armies and getting back into power, like nonstop seesaw. During these like melee years, the Egyptians fatefully involved the Romans in their politics and dynastic struggles. Hindsight being 2020, the worst year ever, several instances of this involvement give some heavy foreshadowing to the level of influence and later control that Rome would have over Egyptian politics in the late Republic through like Roman power brokers like Pompey and Caesar. Several times, each brother entreated Rome to side with them against the other brother for one reason or another. And that led to Physcon leaving Cyrene as well to the Roman people at one point. And then in the next generation, his son left Cyprus to the Romans in his will. So like, you see already, like, you don't want to involve a third party like this much in your struggles. The whole thing is a recipe for disaster in the long term. So
yeah, and leaving land to Rome was by no means uncommon at that period. I mean, it created favor and created alliances. I just thought of something really funny and stupid. Do you want to hear it?
Yes, please.
I would love if Ptolemy Philometor decided to, you know, create a new measuring system of philometers, and like it was the length of him, and so like he would measure his country in like philometers. No, is that terrible?
Do you know what though? It's just as legit as measuring by your forearm, right?
So, yeah, exactly.
Why not? It's just arbitrary and sizes.
It would be really funny. Like, imagine if he wants a new road built, and he's like, "Oh, I want it to be, you know, 20,000 kilometers," and they build that, and then like by the time it's built, he's older and he's like shorter, and he's like, "This is way too long." Because the kilometer had changed.
You're terrible. I feel like that could be worked into some sort of Euripidean riddle. Yeah, so I think all in all, in this part of their brother battle with each other, to be fair, it seems like Philometor did try and have his brother murdered at least once, but let's be honest, probably more. And they did eventually come to an arrangement for peace, but by which Philometor gave his brother cash and prizes and to stay as king in Cyrene in North Africa. So he was sort of like, you just stay in your side and don't come over to mine and we'll be fine. So that was kind of the peace treaty they worked out. And this was all good until 145 BCE when Philometor died and Cleopatra fled to Memphis with her children once Physcon led an army to install himself as king. So the queen was compelled to marry her brother to protect her children, particularly her eldest son, who would eventually be the next king. So she thought. And it's probably a good idea. I'm going to pause right here in the story to kind of mention the importance of duality in women in rulership with men in rulership in Egypt, because these were not love matches. So every time you read something about the Ptolemies, the Ptolemy kids marrying each other, this is not like because they fancied each other by any means. One would not assume. This was like they were compelled to do so to maintain the traditions of Egypt before they arrived as a foreign conquering power, but also to maintain power within themselves. And sometimes it's very gray as to where the female member came from, because the lineage of the males is always quite clear. But sometimes it's like, is it a sister? Is it a daughter? Is it a cousin? Like, it's not always clear.
Don't tell me that there were brothers marrying daughters and stuff like that.
So I think not so much
the fathers marrying
not the Ptolemies, but in a I can't remember which pharaoh it was, but there was an Egyptian pharaoh at one point who I believe married his daughter after. She was maybe his third wife, and that was weird. Yeah. So, I mean, the precedent was set. These guys were not inventing this crazy wheelhouse that they were driving in, but, like, they definitely doubled down on it. And there always needed to be a pharaoh or a king, even if it was an infant, and the queen could be the regent to maintain continuity. And, yeah, so they're thousands of years old cultural practice of having a ruler who were the living embodiment of the gods was continued by the Ptolemies, and marriage of a full or half-blood family member solidified one's claims over the throne. And it took care to shore up some of the political factions that might have supported one brother over another brother, which was the case with the Super Ptolemy Bros here. Their constant fighting divided the kingdom with ongoing civil wars. And to ensure that those who supported the deceased brother and sister wife were now supporting him, Physcon married his brother's widow.
More marriages. Oh my God. This is getting spicy.
So spicy. So the amount of choice a queen had in all this seems to me quite minimal.
Are you trying to tell me that a woman in history didn't get a say in who she married? That's... What?
I know. I can literally hear the minds blowing all around the world as I say that. Just pop, 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 pop. So though Cleopatra too had been very powerful in her own right during her reign with Philometor, they ruled equally. She ruled alongside her brother, husband, and there's a lot of evidence for this archaeologically, in relief carvings and temples that show and name, importantly, the queen on the temples in an active role, engaging with the gods on her own, like with him, but she's doing it at the same level that he is. And rather than like exclusively being passive and standing behind the husband in relief carving, it's sort of like he is the powerful one, whereas she's presented as an equal power. And so she was named on legal documents as well and initiatives, and appears to have been quite powerful on her own and beloved of the citizens. So this is why, to me, given their rocky history, I kind of doubt this was a positive union between her and her younger brother Physcon.
So I'm not going to add anything of great riches to what I'm about to say, but isn't it wild that only in like studying ancient history and classics does the term brother, husband, and sister, wife, not make you bat an eye?
Yeah, no, 100%.
Because you're like, oh, I'm the brother, husband, and like anyone else would be like, what did you just say?
No, and this is the tip of the iceberg. It's just gonna, yeah. If you can imagine a car crash, it's just about to start. especially with, let's say, complicated relationship statuses of all of these individuals, you have to take a very dispassionate step back and be like, it's fine, whatever. Things take a really dark turn after the birth of Cleopatra II and Physcon's first and only child, since immediately after the birth of this son, Physcon murders her eldest son and his nephew. Ensuring that it will be his line that carries on after his death, not the child of his brother. So pretty terrible uncle, right?
There are things to be said about the golden cage and what power does to people, yeah.
Right? And it's about to get worse. So Physcon got a little too close, to his teenage niece, Cleopatra III, who I will be calling now the younger, and Cleopatra II will now be the elder, to keep things straight. And it appears that he courted and married his niece under the nose of his wife, her own mother.
I'm a bit confused by that. Sorry, would you mind just explaining that again?
Yeah, so Physcon is the younger brother of Cleopatra II, and she had a child with Philometor. So that is her daughter is a teenager now, and her name is also Cleopatra, because mothers and daughters named each other up, you know, that kind of thing. At this point, Cleopatra the elder, number two, is married to her brother, Ptolemy Physcon. Mm-hmm. And He then seduces, heavy air quotes, gets involved with his teenage niece, Cleopatra III, the younger. So that's how, that is the situation
Gross.
We are in. Yes.
So he is interested in his sister's child.
Yes.
That's what we're looking at right now.
Yeah.
Okay. And are we talking about it in terms of a political sense? He wants to sort of gain power in the next generation, or is he interested in a different way?
It's not really explicitly said, because obviously you can't know looking in the past why people mm-hmm. did what they did exactly. But his sister, Cleopatra II, is seemingly quite an independent woman in a lot of ways. Like, she is powerful, she is making decisions for herself, and she is the senior queen in this scenario. So he's hooked up with her daughter, who is more malleable. Like, you know, it kind of makes sense. Like, a lot of cases in ancient history, and I guess the modern world too, older men marry younger women because they're quite malleable. Like, they don't have their own power bases, they don't necessarily have their own ways of doing things, whereas he is clearly butting heads and not able to get one over his sister. Potentially she was attractive and a teenager as well, but like, I think it's more to do with, if he can have her, he still has a valid queen and wife.
Yeah.
And he can usurp power away from his current wife.
I see. Okay. My lord, this is
oh, I know.
This is something else.
Kind of just surprised he didn't just murder her, but I mean, maybe she was very well protected. Who knows?
Yeah, and I think as well, there's so many cases in history where you think, why didn't they just murder that person? It's obviously much more complicated to do that.
Because they probably would have.
Yeah.
So this crazy situation boiled over into yet another civil war between Physcon and Cleopatra the Younger against Cleopatra the Elder. Tore the country in two. Like, between 132 and 126 BCE, Cleopatra the Elder gained and held control over Alexandria because she had a lot of support among the populace, and the Alexandrians had rioted and tried to kill Physcon, and as well as his junior wife and their kids. So they fled the palace and he went to Cyprus, including the young son he had with Cleopatra the Elder. So Cleopatra the Elder maintained control in Alexandria. So she was very popular before, and her reign was sort of associated with, I guess, the most recent memory of peace and stability and economic growth and things like that. So she had a good reputation behind her and the support of the people. She also had herself crowned as the sole queen. And this was the first time a Ptolemaic woman had done this. And she assumed the title Thea Philometer Soteria, which means mother loving savior goddess. So she's just laying all the epithets on herself, linking her name back to Ptolemy I, the founder of the dynasty, through the Soteria, and linking herself to her brother, because he called himself Philometer as well, mother lover. So, you know, she's sort of bringing it all together to be like, I'm good on my own and you should follow me because of these things.
But she's still doing this with her rival brother out there.
Yes, he is just across the water in Cyprus. So he's not far at all.
So she's shoring up support on mainland Egypt. I'm sure this is going to end well for her.
Awkward smile. So in this period of exile, Physcon was so enraged by the turn of events that he had his son with Cleopatra the Elder not just murdered, but dismembered as well. And then he sent the body pieces to her for her birthday.
Okay, a powerful message, definitely.
Yeah, I mean, you know, really, I wonder what he's trying to say.
I think it's the equivalent of, you know, when you're in the office and you send a message to someone, but you put a GIF in there as well, just to really drive home what you want to say.
Definitely just like that. This very Game of Thrones. In all things, the balance of power changed again, and their complicated back and forth of exile and return led Cleopatra the Elder to go to the Seleucid kingdom in Syria for support, looking for alliances, because God knows where else she could go at this point, and to help defeat her brother. But unfortunately, she was compelled to not just reconcile with him and rejoin him in a co-rulership with her daughter and his other wife. That's it. Like, go back. So she did in 126 BCE.
I can only imagine that the Seleucids were busy with something else, because any chance to get one over on the Ptolemies, they would have usually taken. So I'm really interested in that. I wonder why.
Yeah, I think one of her daughters was married to one of the Seleucids at that point,
mm-hmm.
which would make sense that she might go there for support, but that they didn't give any, I mean, they were probably involved elsewhere or something like that. If, you know, in this one shifting of power, she lost out. So Ptolemy was victorious and ruled alongside Cleopatra II and Cleopatra III until his death in 116 BCE. And the two Cleopatras continued to co-rule with Cleopatra the Younger's son, Ptolemy IX, for the next year until the death of Cleopatra the Elder when she was around 70 years old, roughly, you know, maybe 115, 114, somewhere in there. So it wasn't very much longer that she lasted, but she certainly lived to a ripe old age, given how incredibly violent and dangerous it was.
Good for her. She took her multivitamins.
Right. So what do you think that Cleopatra III, the younger, well, I guess now the only, did since she was finally able to wield power without the shadow of her mother?
That's a good question. Part of me wonders whether she ends up marrying a brother, because that is a tradition and shares power, or no. Does she possibly try to consolidate power under a female rulership? Or does she marry her brother maybe and shares power? Which one of those could it be?
So interestingly, she maintains power ish on her own. She's still a co-ruler with her son, Ptolemy IX, but in a very expected, very Ptolemy twist of she expels her son, who she had been spent this whole time grooming for power and rulership, and replaces him with another son, Ptolemy X. Doesn't really matter. It's 9 and 10. Like, they follow each other sequentially. And obviously those two sons have a, you know, a civil war amongst each other and all this crap that just keeps going on and on. But what's sort of funny is they rule together for a few years. And then eventually Ptolemy X has his mother murdered in 101 BCE, ending the whole sordid wild journey of the two Ptolemies and concurrent Cleopatra. So just like, what a gong show. Like, I can't even, yeah.
That's multi-generational madness and mayhem.
Manslaughter.
And mutilation. What else we can throw in there? Like, poor
matricide.
Poor baby Ptolemy. Yeah, matricide. Wow, that is a wild journey. I was even somewhat confused by all those names. You're right. But you did a really good job of keeping us going there, Sophia.
Thank you. So the story, of course, doesn't stop there, because there's still like another, oh, I'm going to say 70 years of Ptolemaic infighting and sibling rivalries and intermarriages.
Sibling love.
So, yeah, I guess you could say that. But this is where we'll stop for now. But yeah, these two Cleopatras, when I came across it, I couldn't imagine a more awkward situation. Like, it's not normal for ancient history either. So I hope you enjoyed my wild journey.
No, it was awesome. And I think it is important to point out that this is definitely an anomaly. There are other occasions of, I know, like inter-family marriage and things like that in other cultures, but it's definitely the rarity.
Yeah. Well, that is my story. Now, I'm really excited to hear about the anarchy, a term I've never heard applied to the 12th century. So this is fascinating. Let's jump in.
Yep. So we're going to move about a millennium ahead in time, but we're not going to move away from relatives being really mean to each other and causing issues. On the plus side, in this story, there are no sister wives or brother husbands. So, like, let's take that as a plus. Yeah, so we're going to go to the 12th century. So I want you to close your eyes and transport yourself there. Okay.
Eyes are closed. Breathing.
That noise was the sound of you traveling through time.
Right.
Okay, good. And we're actually going to a story that's relatively well known. It's a very famous example of familial rivalry. And we're going to go to early medieval England and France. So, story goes, the King of England, Henry I, and he'd ruled England since 1100, okay? But he died in 1135. Now, he was considered an effective ruler, but like a harsh ruler. You know, these typical, like, he was a harsh ruler, but very effective. And it's like, ugh, you know, what does that really mean? Was he really, how many people did he kill? You know?
Yeah, I was going to ask, what does that translate into numbers of bodies?
Yes, exactly. And of course, when he died, as often is the case when you have, you know, what's considered a strong ruler, there's a power vacuum left.
Yeah.
And without a doubt, family infighting ended up filling that void. Now, the problem was that his only legitimate son had actually died in a ship sinking in 1120. And this was the famous incident of the sinking of the White Ship, when also 300 other people died, but like, you know, whatever about them. And the important thing is that the son of the king had died. So no like clear legitimate heir. So because of this, when Henry I died, his favorite nephew, Stephen, who was the son of his sister Adela and the powerful Count Stephen of Blois, which is a region of France, he rushed to London, and Stephen actually had himself crowned king. And then his kingship was confirmed by the Pope, and the crowds of London, who actually also traditionally had some sort of influence in proclaiming the king, all said, yep, he's the king. So we got King Stephen. It all sounds good so far?
Yeah, it checks out.
However, there was one problem, and this problem was a lady. Because
because
so the rulership and inheritance of the crown actually had been promised to Stephen's cousin Matilda, who was actually Henry's only living legitimate child. It was his daughter. Now, what do you think the problem with Matilda could have been?
My suspicion, if pressed, is that she doesn't have a penis.
Exactly. Yes. This crown is not for Matilda. Is that joke going across? Like, yeah, okay, cool.
This is for Matilda.
This is for Matilda. This crown is
some
not
good
for Matilda.
Alt J.
So Henry's only legitimate child, being female, was pretty complicated because England had not had a sole female monarch before, and they basically didn't know what to do with it. And I don't know if you know this, Sophia, but historically, women weren't always favored over men.
I just can't picture that, though. That just seems so untrue based on experience and history.
So a little bit more about Matilda. She had actually been married to Henry V, who was the Holy Roman Emperor. Pretty important guy, pretty important position. Pretty much the
King of Kings.
King of Kings, yeah. Like he sort of loosely, I suppose, ruled over the Confederation of German and Italian and other states in Central Europe. Most of Christendom. He was considered like the inheritor of the Roman Empire, according to the Pope. But like trying to tell the Byzantines, they would have none of that.
So Matilda is married to the Holy Roman Emperor currently, or she was.
She was.
She was. So marrying anyone after him seems like a step down.
Bit of a step down. Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
Like just kind of bars low. She's just,
You know what? That's what happens, because she did actually have to have a second marriage, because in 1225, Henry V, the Holy Roman Emperor, died. And Matilda did actually get the title Empress out of this, which is pretty cool. But what she went on to do is remarry Geoffrey V of Anjou in 1128, who was a very important French noble. And his county actually bordered the Duchy of Normandy. Now, Sophia, why would Normandy be important in this story?
Probably all of the connections with the kind of ruling elite of England have their provenance from Normandy. And and it's also like a really important political connection as well. Entrance into France.
Exactly. The Duchy of Normandy was very much connected with England because, I mean, it was William the Conqueror who took over England, came from Normandy. He was a Norman lord. Now, Matilda had obviously been married to very powerful people. She knows what she's doing. So Henry I, King of England, he actually had attempted to build up a base of political support after the death of his son. So he really did want Matilda to inherit the crown, to inherit control of England and Normandy. And he actually went to the extent to demanding that his court and all the barons take oaths of fealty to Matilda if she were to take the crown. Clearly, they did not abide by these oaths because there was quite a lot of support in England for Stephen and not so much for her. And that's why Stephen was able to just sweep in and gain control of a lot of the English barons and control of you know, the land across the Channel.
So Stephen had already been kind of proclaimed king at this point. Or is he sort of building up to that?
Yep. So Henry I, King of England, he dies. Matilda is married to the Count of Anjou. She's in kind of like the area of France. And Stephen decides to sweep in immediately and be like, I'm king. And he's, you know, the Pope says so. A lot of the English barons say so. And the people of London say so.
So he's kind of like stealing an election, you might say.
Scandalo. he did. He did. And this led to a charming little time known as the Anarchy.
Sounds good.
So Stephen was apparently charming and attractive when required. He was a brave warrior. But at the same time, he lacked ruthlessness and he failed to inspire loyalty, which means maybe he didn't kill enough people in time.
So I also like the inclusion of when required. But so if he was a very good warrior and charming and all these things, but didn't inspire loyalty, that's an interesting omission in his skill set.
Exactly. And this causes a bit of trouble like down the line, as we'll find out. And he wasn't always able to control like a lot of his powerful friends or his, you know, or even sort of put a stamp down on his enemies, obviously, because there was this other legitimate person out there. Now, And obviously you can tell that Matilda wasn't happy about all of this. Do you think she took it lying down?
I'm going to say no. I feel warrior queen.
No, she didn't. I mean, she's an empress, you know?
Yeah. Who the hell is Stephen?
Exactly. Now, we don't know a lot about Matilda's earliest life. She probably stayed with her mother and was like brought up within like her fold. She could read. She was obviously educated. There's no great detailed description of her appearance, which I don't think is that big a deal. But obviously, like historically, people like to know what like women look like in history and judge them from that. So some say she was very beautiful, but like we have no evidence of this.
It's the classic historian question. But was she hot? Like,
yeah, was she hot?
Like Cleopatra knew 7 languages and like did all this other crazy stuff. But like, but what I really need to know is, was she hot?
Was she like totally like, bodacious?
Right. Like just who cares? I see this as a common trope.
Yeah. And that's a good point. Cause the amount of debate that still goes on to this day, did Cleopatra have a big nose? There's documentaries about that. Like really?
No.
So Matilda is clearly a capable woman, which is the most important thing here. Now, while Stephen is trying to secure his control in England, Matilda obviously rallies support. She said, no, I'm not going to renounce this crown. This was promised to me. And her claim was actually upheld by her half-brother, Robert of Gloucester. And he's a really important guy because he's one of Henry I's illegitimate sons. And as well as this, her uncle was King David I of Scotland.
Oh, mm-hmm. But a connection.
So, yeah, I know. And so he was a powerful guy to have on your doorstep, really. And what happened to Stephen was that for the first few years of his rule, he had to deal with Scottish invasions. He had to deal with problems in the north of England, a Welsh rebellion, Geoffrey of Anjou attacked Normandy. So there were quite a few things to deal with, but Stephen did actually manage to deal with a lot of this and actually shored up his power for the first few years as king. So he was doing quite well.
Interesting. Wow. That is a lot to take on all at once. So yeah, props.
So Matilda obviously bided her time, and it was actually in 1139 when she arrived in England to claim her throne. And she first stopped at Arundel Castle, and she stayed with her stepmother while Robert, remember Robert of Gloucester?
Yeah.
Yeah. He's kind of like the military, her military arm, really. He attempted to rally support like right across the country. What do you think Stephen did about all this?
I mean, maybe cut off supply trains or disrupt communication, some sort of hobble her at the knees kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, he went right for her. He just besieged the castle she was in, and oh, yeah,
he's not wasting time.
Yeah, just trapped Matilda inside. And it's interesting because she actually hadn't declared herself as the main threat to him at this point, and because of this they kind of negotiated a little bit, and he did allow her to leave and to meet up with Robert. They actually met up in Bristol, which probably wasn't the best idea, as you can imagine.
Not.
Yeah, so she actually ended up establishing her base there, and she was lucky to get out, to be honest. So she established her base in the southwest. She was lucky to get out of that, all of it. And over the next few years, what kind of happened was that fighting did commence, and there were little battles and skirmishes and just a lot of little minor things happening around as Stephen tried to reclaim the kingdom, and Matilda was sort of like, you know, picking at it a little bit and like boop, 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 poking.
So there was no like massive attack, no real attempt to just wipe it out. It was sort of like a tit for tat for a while, that kind of thing.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I think this must have something to do with sort of feudal politics and family mm-hmm. politics, because he didn't just like squash her immediately. Maybe he didn't see her as much of as big a threat as she could be. And it's interesting because there are, in a way, two rulers of one land. But I think part of the issue was that Stephen did have a lot of support in England at mm-hmm. that time, and Matilda probably needed to spend time, you know, looking for new supporters, pointing out all the problems with Stephen, and just waiting and biding her time. And that's probably what she was doing. And you can imagine like little skirmishes and everything, just destabilizing things little bit by bit, making Stephen look weak, hit and run there, stealing a carriage there, all this sort of thing. So for quite a while, Stephen did look secure until things did start to change. Some of the nobles started to become very annoyed with Stephen and became quite disloyal, mainly because he started promoting his own friends over the rights of what the nobles would have called like their normal rights, their like hereditary rights.
Nepotism game was strong, and it possibly, I'm gonna guess, with people who weren't necessarily the right pecking order to be giving those jobs to, something like that.
Exactly. So he might be giving it to Count such and such of such and such, such and such of such and such, instead of, say, to the Duke of Northumberland, who really should be doing this particular role. And really bad move on his part. He also managed to turn the clergy against him, who were very important on like a grassroots level, because he arrested Roger, who was the Bishop of Salisbury, and that really, they felt like he overstepped his power at that point. Now, in 1141, while all of this is happening, Stephen decides to besiege Lincoln Castle, which was in support of Matilda. As this was going on, forces led by Robert of Gloucester, remember Matilda's right-hand man, came down and attacked Stephen's forces and routed Stephen, who was defeated. I see whose side you're on at the moment.
I mean, a little. I'm biased.
Now, Stephen was also captured and he was taken to Bristol and held prisoner by Matilda. So, huge coup on Matilda's part.
Yeah.
And his confinement lasted for almost 9 months.
Oh, and damn.
Do you think Matilda was nice to him?
I mean, were it me, I wouldn't be. But she might have been. I don't think so.
She wasn't. I mean, which is sad because, you know, he showed her mercy in the past, but she did not do this for him. Even though he was kind of the king, like God's anointed king in England, according to the Pope and everything, his legs were chained and he was quite badly mistreated. And these reports did get out to the populace and to the lords. And actually, they kind of lessened Matilda's popularity because it was seen as this isn't appropriate what you're doing.
An overstep with like the holy sacred body of the king.
As Stephen was behind bars, obviously Matilda took her chance to extend her power, and she actually made it as far as Westminster. And she put preparations in place for her coronation.
Wow.
But what happened was that she quickly lost support from the people of London, who had previously supported Stephen and had proclaimed him king. And this might seem strange why this was important at a time when it was very an aristocratic system, but apparently this was important, having the voice of the people of London. And then an angry mob and the London militia actually advanced on Westminster to attack her, and she was forced to flee to Oxford.
Huh. That's wild. Like, I can kind of see it in a way. Just, I mean, up to this point, she's a foreigner. She's come in the aggressor rather than the defender stance. So it might have been different if she had been, you know, like if Stephen had come from elsewhere to try and take the throne, that kind of thing. But also, I think probably at this point, the fact that she is a woman taking effectively the most powerful job and position in the country is probably the bigger part of this that's really not sitting well with people.
I mean these people see Stephen as their king as well, and in a way she's a usurper, because I mean, I don't know how much do they care about the fact that Henry I had really wanted her and to be the next legitimate like heir, and that he promised the nobles, like what does that mean to them?
Probably nothing.
So now, generally still things are looking good for Matilda, because she does have her main enemy, Stephen, in her captivity. But, in September 1141, Robert of Gloucester, one of her best supporters, was captured at Winchester by Stephen's queen, who was interestingly also called Matilda. So we have a Cleopatra problem happening. Yeah, I know. And what happens is that they decided on an exchange to get Robert back. Who do you think that they exchanged him for?
Well, it certainly wasn't it was the king.
Yeah, it was the king, which again, I just think is a wild choice, because it's like trading your knight for a king in chess. You just don't do it.
Well, yeah. And sometimes some of the nobles, like I'm guessing Robert of Gloucester was probably like just super powerful. Like if he is basically her I mean, in a way, he's sort of foreign Matilda's co-captain and things. Like, he's got tons of money. He's very well connected, very powerful. So, I mean, though he doesn't have the title, maybe, like, in terms of, like, money and impact, his status wasn't desperately far away from a king, possibly.
Yeah, and that's a good point. And it might have been better to face Stephen on the battlefield with Robert than face Stephen's allies without Robert.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, too. Also, really cool that Stephen's wife led an army to go get her husband back, girl.
I know. There you go. All the Matildas on the table.
I know, right?
Now, so Robert was exchanged for Stephen, which really weakened Matilda's position. And Stephen, unsurprisingly, decided to attack Oxford, besieged his castle, and Matilda was forced to flee. So it's kind of this back and forth keeps happening. The war continued with tit and tat, and there was no upper hand for quite a while, until in 1147, Robert of Gloucester died. And with him went the main thrust of, you know, his lands, his troops, and Matilda's military campaign. And what she decided to do was to leave for Normandy the following year and just leave England.
Smart move, probably.
Mm-hmm. And she passed the claim to the throne to her son, whose name was Henry Plantagenet.
Yes, it all clicks name back.
Make sense, Plantagenet?
Yes, I feel like there's going to be a long and complicated war coming.
And now we're into the third generation of this crisis. We're talking about, you know, is this being passed on to the son? So it went from Henry I to Henry Plantagenet through Matilda and Stephen. Yeah. And Henry actually continued this war, and he did enjoy military success in Normandy and then set his sights in England. And in 1153, he started a really effective campaign on the island and managed to take back control of much of the country with actually little fighting.
Really?
Oh. Yeah. I think Stephen just like, I don't know, the fight wasn't in him anymore. Or possibly Henry found a lot of support and Stephen was in disarray.
Because there must have been something about Henry that Matilda just didn't have, and I really can't put my finger on it.
Yes, Henry had something, just something that was different.
Charisma, uniqueness, nerve.
Henry Plantagenet, he's pretty much winning the whole war. And in Wallingford in July 1153, Stephen's forces are camped on one side, Henry's forces are camped on the other side of the River Thames, and the barons on both sides, they actually refuse to fight. They say, no.
Good for them.
We're done. And they decided to have a peace amongst themselves, and they forced Henry and Stephen to do the same. Now, there were a few more skirmishes while this peace was ironed out, but it's interesting how the barons, it just shows how much power they have in this situation.
And how done they were with everything.
They were done right? with this whole situation. Because there was two men fighting now. It's like, hey, what's the point anymore, guys?
Yeah. I mean, obviously, either one of you is fine.
This is so funny. So it's interesting because Stephen actually had a son who was called Eustace. How do you think he felt about this whole truce?
Probably a little threatened.
Yeah, a little threatened. But don't worry, he died. So there was nothing
clearing
the way. And then the Treaty of Winchester happened next. And Stephen decided that he would continue his rule, but Henry Plantagenet would be the successor.
Interesting. Just kind of piece it all together and just appease all the different parties. Yeah,
exactly. And do you know what? Henry didn't have to wait long because it was the next year in 1154 that Stephen died.
I know.
And Henry Plantagenet became Henry II. He was the first of the Plantagenet dynasty that ruled England until 1485. So one of England's most significant dynasties.
Yeah, that's a good long run.
Yeah. And look, story of two cousins just bashing it out, and uncles and nephews and fourth cousins and third cousins and no sister brothers. It's all a mess. But you know what? It worked out well in the end for Henry Plantagenet.
It sure did. I mean, somebody always wins, right?
Yeah.
So, that's a beast. Okay. It's interesting though. Like I hadn't really been that aware of how much of that campaign was led by Matilda. I sort of thought she was a little more passive in how that would play out, but it's like, she's clearly like just right in the front line. Well, not in the front lines, let's say that she wouldn't be, but she's obviously like very present and in all of these locations with it. So,
and I mean, yeah, she didn't just like sit waiting in Normandy in kind of relative safety. She was out there. She was besieged in the castles. And, you know, she was doing it. But I suppose she had to be in England to show her commitment to the cause, to her cause.
That's true. Well, that's awesome. Thank you, Liam. That was a really, edge of the seat kind of story. Just like, what's going to happen next?
So you're welcome.
That was a good choice. Good choice.
Shall we move on to So What?
So now we're going to jump into our section, So What, where we tie everything together and just have a little bit of a chat about what it all kind of means and maybe why we should care.
So, Sophia, why should we care about sisters marrying brothers and uncles marrying nieces and Ptolemies and many Cleopatras and many Ptolemies?
Yeah, I mean, the incestuous dynastic marriages are just what they did, and it clearly didn't super work out in a lot of ways for them, so maybe not effective.
I mean, I think it's like a good example of, you know, another reason why these marriages probably shouldn't happen. And also just like the Ptolemies in trying to shore up their power and, create centralized power within their dynasty by marrying each other actually ended up causing far more fractures than possibly having one ruler.
Absolutely. I think one of the interesting things about Macedonian marriage customs were polygamous. So the ruling king could have multiple wives across different areas, and that would obviously create conflicts inevitably once, you know, you had powerful queens wanting their children to succeed the king, as exemplified par excellence by Alexander the Great and Philip II. The Ptolemies, coming from that tradition, could have gone that way, but they chose not to. They chose to, you know, to consolidate power, and you know, that's all well and good. Their dynasty, it lasted a few hundred years, but what's interesting about Ptolemaic history, and one of the challenges about it, is there are gaps in terms of the understanding where the females are in it, or, you know, a lot of times you know the queen is named, but you don't actually know whose child she is, or if she's in fact a daughter or a wife. Often our best clues are through visual representations. So in the iconography that the queens would have created of themselves, certain queens would brand themselves with a type of crown or a certain hairstyle. And that's usually how you can differentiate who's who. But another layer of complication is that the queens quite early on merge their iconography with images of divine goddesses like Isis and Hathor and other things. So you sometimes really can't tell if you're looking at a queen or a goddess or both. Again, it's just there is a lot of material culture and documents and things that survive from Egypt. In terms of understanding how the queen's histories were and what their actual power was and how they operated, it's kind of hard to figure it out sometimes.
No, I think you did a good job of it, because it is a bit of a mess. It's hard enough to just get past the fact that everyone has the same name over hundreds of years and they're all marrying each other. So like, it's a moral lesson for us all.
Cleopatra III had two daughters named Cleopatra, and that becomes like a whole complicated mess of marrying their brothers and who divorce or kill them. You know, one of her daughters, Cleopatra Selene, is married to Ptolemy IX, Ptolemy X. She's sent to Syria. She marries Antiochus VIII, and then Antiochus IX, and then Antiochus X. And you're just like, what is your life? That she's sent off to the Seleucid dynasty, and three iterations of Seleucids marry her because she's so valuable. Like, that's just wild.
It's wild. I think the interesting thing about the Ptolemies is that, you know, for many dynasties, this something like what you just discussed could be the preeminent example of like intrigue. And it's like, no, that's just like that generation's
craziness. That's just one.
And the same thing happens the next one. The same thing happened before. You know, it's madness.
I think it's important to look into their dynasty, because there's so much of Egypt in the modern world, and a lot of that came to us because of this dynasty. There was a lot of interest in projecting themselves into the Mediterranean, and then, you know, the next group of people to conquer Egypt, the Romans, take their material culture and they erected in cities called Egyptiaca, and you take obelisks and you put them in your capital cities to show that you now control that city. But all of that starts in this period. Like, it's through the Roman conquest of Egypt. It's what the Ptolemaic dynasty is building in Egypt that becomes so desirable for the Romans and others. So their influence is still with us today. It's just very complicated to figure out who they were other than Cleopatra VII. So that's my so what. And I could go on about Egyptiaca and the Roman world forever, but I won't. So let's move on to Liam. So why should we care about Matilda and the conquest of England?
Well, because it's a pretty cool story. But more importantly, I think it's so interesting how rulers can do everything in their power to ensure transition between their rule to their chosen successor. Mm. And when this is a woman, this gets so complicated, because women rulers in history start off with such a weak position. And it's so interesting that you get the example of Matilda, who knows that she is, I suppose, legitimately the heir in her eyes and according to like the laws of the time, and fights for it, which is really fascinating. But that doesn't always necessarily mean that she's the best ruler for it, which is crazy too, because if you think about it, Stephen did a really good job of showing up power and fighting off all of the different threats that they had. But then at the same time, he decided to centralize power in his own hands and with his own friends. But would Matilda have done anything different? It's just all of these kind of ifs and buts and candy and nuts that I think are so fascinating. And in terms of today, I mean, we have a president in America challenging what is the democratic right of the people. And Stephen did the same thing. He usurped power over what was at the time the legitimate right of Matilda. Okay. And it's just interesting to see these stories continue.
Yeah, and he used popular support to stay in power. So, but
exactly,
like loud,
yeah. Yeah, subvert,
active popular support.
Yeah, exactly. It's just subverted things. It's also interesting how it's so easy to alienate followers during times of civil war, because when you are fighting an external enemy, it's easy to rally support behind you because it's us and them. But when it's a choice between this legitimate person or that legitimate person, and all the cousins are related to each other, it's kind of, it gets very messy for people. And it's very easy, I think, for to push someone to the other side of the spectrum when the spectrum is only just a different branch of the same family.
Yeah, actually, that's an interesting sort of parallel into the story I was telling, because with so many ongoing civil wars, it was hard to, like, well, who, what side? How does it fall on which side? And it frequently looked like Philometor and Cleopatra too had the support of the Greeks and the Alexandrians and those types of people, the Macedonians who were in Alexandria and whatever. And interestingly, Physcon and Cleopatra III had the support of the native Egyptians. Not sure why. there's some stuff written about them promoting, like putting native Egyptian people into positions of power within their governments and things like that. So sort of moving away from the Ptolemaic tradition of just Greek nepotism or Macedonian nepotism, but which could explain it. But again, it's you're right, because it's, well, what's so different about these people from those people?
And my final point is that power and authority and rulership of great numbers of people should never be left in the hands of a family, because history is pretty much a lesson of let's not let families control power, because it's messy, it's stinky, and it doesn't work very well. Mm-hmm. Well, Sophia, looks like we've solved all of the big problems of the world today. Yeah, I think everyone should just listen to us and we will solve. We fixed things. So yeah, congratulations.
Done and dusted. Well done, sir. Well done. So yeah, that was fun. And thank you for joining us as we explored these stories together. In our next episode, we will be discussing the topic Sacred Waters.
If you leave us a review on whatever platform you're using, that would be fantastic. It really helps us. And if you like the show, please consider becoming one of our patrons through Patreon. It's a system where you can sign up and support us with different, like, small amounts of money. It really helps. And we put the money back into the show. It means we can produce more and just bring you more awesome content. And it's just so nice to know there's people out there supporting us. So please, if you have the time and resources, like, have a look and consider supporting us. Thanks.
Yes. And you can also check out our Instagram at Two Friends Talk History, where we will be adding images, and especially for today's episode, some maps, images of portraits and coins, so you can get a sense of what the characters we talked about looked like today.
And also, I run another podcast called International Supernatural, where I explore spooky things, folklore, and other nonsense like that. So head over there if you like listening to the sound of my voice.
Brilliant. And I run a website, archaeoartist.com, with different types of public outreach materials, travel blog, art and archaeology about the ancient world that I create. So if you're interested in the art that comes along with these episodes, or just curious in general about these types of research activities, you are more than welcome to check it out. And we are so grateful for you having a listen. See you next time.
See you next time. Bye, Sophia.
Bye. In our next episode, we will be discussing
sexy turtles.